clearly you guys have been playing around with Practice Lab. So there was a question about March, if you've been trying to calculate shared responsibility payments. Yeah, there's I've come across a glitch in the month of March in that ACA worksheet. I don't know what the deal is. Sometimes I get the error, sometimes I don't. Yeah, it's pretty annoying. We noticed that too, and it's been sent along to TaxWise. I'm sure that they'll fix it.
Why not use the exemption code H for AVA in September as well?
Oh, that's a great question. So we didn't use the exemption code H for AVA for September because she had coverage in September. So she didn't need an exemption because she had coverage for September. Now, Ava could have gotten, I mean, if Ava did not have coverage until October, if she was born in September, got coverage in October, then we certainly could have allowed her to have that exemption code H for September. But she didn't need it because she was already enrolled in Medicaid for at least one day in the month of September. And we just had another question about, so why can't Janie get the coverage gap exemption? And that's because the coverage gap is for fewer than 3 months. And here we've got a gap of 3 months. And so in this case, the gap is too long to qualify to use the short coverage gap exemption. It would need to be, you know, she would have needed to get some coverage in March. We said her coverage started in April in this variation. So this, unfortunately, the short coverage gap exemption is not available to Janie. And you're not able to use it for, you know, part of the gap. So she was uninsured just a little too long to qualify for that exemption.
A couple of people had questions about code H, the exemption code H, and that is a new exemption this year. We actually have the first two webinars in this series, the very first one, part one, actually went into all of the exemptions. So if you just have general questions about exemptions, I can I'll send around a link to that webinar as well so you can review that. But for code H specifically, could you just very quickly explain it? And it's not in publication 4012 right now. So is it going to be updated, or was that an old version?
It should be in the 4012. I thought that I'd look that up, actually. Bill, can you confirm it's in the 4012? It's in the 8965 instructions.
Yeah, so the 4012 had some corrections and or late additions, and in fact it may still have more because of extender legislation. And so I would just recommend that make sure that you have printed out 4491X, which is the corrections and additions document. And that's why the 4012 this year was actually in kind of loose leaf binder, so you can substitute pages as they're updated. I'd have to go in and look at that. If it's not in the 4491X yet, it will be prior to the start of the filing season.
So one of our helpful listeners says it's in the 4012 on page ACA-6. And this is code H is a new exemption, or it's been sort of repurposed, and it covers. It's basically a way to, you know, as we're laying out who had insurance, who had exemption, and who owes a shared responsibility payment, it's a way to account for the months where certain people who were born, adopted, or died during the year were not required to have coverage. So it's just trying to sort of fill in the gap so we can understand everyone's insurance exemption situation on the tax return. So as we said earlier, the coverage requirement is for full months alive. So if someone dies in May, then their coverage requirement was January through April. And then in May through the rest of the year, if you're filing a tax return for this person or with this person, from May through the rest of the year, they could claim a code H exemption, because obviously there's going to be no penalty for failure to have coverage for someone who is deceased. So it's just kind of helping to fill in the gaps on exemptions, just honestly probably to make sure that we're not over-assessing on, you know, accidentally over-assessing the shared responsibility payment.
Right. And I would just add that I think that the 4491X does have code H listed, but it's actually for the prior year, 2014 exemption. So, again, that will be updated. There is a new code H, different than the code H that was used last year. So don't get confused by that.
But we had one question with a little confusion over for the family coverage offered by an employer. It covers both Alice and Jeffrey. So why don't you subtract the monthly premium that is covering Jeffrey from this annualized premium cost to determine Alice's exemption?
Well, the answer is that we don't have to do that because what we're looking at is the measure of it's the lowest cost plan that's going to cover Alice, right? And that, in this case, because there's only employer plan, there's a plan for the employee himself, and there's a plan for family. Alice can only qualify for the family plan, and so we use the cost of the family plan. Yes, it's going to include Gregory's. It would be kind of like double coverage for Gregory, right? Because or a double cost for Gregory because he's already paid his premium, but it sort of goes back to the fact that we're adding back in the salary reduction arrangement that was excluded before. So we're kind of adding back in what Gregory has paid. But the bottom line is you don't even have to rationalize it. The bottom line is you do not have to subtract out the cost of self-only coverage. It doesn't matter whether Gregory took the coverage or not. And so, the offer that Alice has is family coverage. And that's the offer that you measure. As complicated as all of this is, you do not need to add that other complication of trying to subtract out the cost of coverage for people who have who took other coverage.
And then do you have just any sort of general, if they don't have this information with them, if they don't have the cost of the employer insurance, where to look for it, or any sort of quick tips on that?
Unfortunately, it's really hard to get this information because the truth is that, Gregory, we have ways of figuring out what the cost of his plan was, right? Because even though we rarely, if ever, use it, he might have his last pay stub available. That's going to be a really good source for seeing something like this that might not be clearly laid out in the W-2 to see what he paid for his insurance. But the problem with doing the affordability exemption and why we emphasize that it really is the last one that you try is that we're talking usually about people who didn't take their offer of coverage. And so if Alice didn't enroll in the offer of coverage through Gregory's work, then that offer of coverage was probably made in, the fall of 2014. We're doing the tax return in the spring of 2016. She's had 16 months to forget about what the cost of the offer was. So it is really hard. I mean, if you're at this point, you might have someone go back and ask their HR office. Their HR office should certainly right. know, but I know that practically speaking, that's not easy to, send someone away to make that kind of call. I wish I had more sort of magic bullets on this, but I don't.
Well, I think Carrie, you hit it on the head, though. Last year, with the payment amount only $95, people might not have been willing or want to go through the hassle to do that. But with the flat dollar amount increasing to $325 this year, per individual, for the flat dollar amount, it may be worth them making that phone call. So, again, it's not easy, but, it's more worthwhile, let's call it.
That's a really good point. Thanks, Bill. And, it's going to get even more critical next year when the shared responsibility payment is even higher. So, maybe after 1 year of doing this, maybe the advice is if you, if you turn down an offer of employer-sponsored coverage, keep a record of what that cost was going to be. Throw it in with your other tax records. So maybe people will get accustomed to having that if they don't take the insurance. I hope so. But you're not missing some magic trick here. It's difficult.
Going back to Max, for if he had applied back when he didn't have any income, let's say he was in a Medicaid non-expansion state, so, you know, he didn't qualify for Medicaid because his state didn't expand. That, for applying for that exemption, that's an actual marketplace exemption. Mm-hmm. So the code G is actually the end of the year exemptions through the IRS, and you don't need to apply for that one.
So what you need to remember is that there is a code G exemption for people in the coverage gap, so people in Medicaid non-expansion states with income below 138% of FPL. So there's an exemption available to them, but remember, we're looking at year-end income, and Max, his year-end income takes him out of that exemption. Now, what we're saying is that there is a second kind, like sort of a variation on the same exemption, which can come from the marketplace if someone applies for Medicaid in one of these coverage gap states or in one of these Medicaid non-expansion states. They're denied Medicaid. The computer is going to spit out for them an exemption for the whole year because they were in the coverage gap. And so some of you, you know, if you're in a non-expansion state, you may have seen these letters come in, but maybe not because people often forget to bring them. But if someone applies for and is denied Medicaid because they're in the coverage gap in one of these non-expansion states, they qualify for an exemption. But if you don't apply, then you can't get it unless you qualify for it at the end of the year, which Max doesn't. So that was Max's opportunity to lock in an exemption. But he didn't apply. So he didn't do that.
And just to we had one more question about this. If Max's income had been below 138% of the poverty line, he could have qualified for the IRS tax exemption at the end of the year. But because he didn't, this exemption is not available to him since his annual income rose above that threshold.
Correct.
Now switching gears. Let's say that there is a big salary increase late in the year, which affects affordability in the early months of the year when you have this annualized income. Is there a way to calculate each month based on monthly income instead of the annual income?
No. That's the kicker here. And that's the frustration that, frankly, that I saw from taxpayers last year when they were in – because this is a case that I saw last year. I made up the numbers. But it was essentially a guy who was unemployed for several months. He's like, I need to pay my rent. I can't buy health insurance. It was truly unaffordable to him at that moment. And he could have qualified for some exemption sort of at the beginning of the process, but he didn't lock anything in. And so then, you know, he gets a job, and then, you know, all of a sudden for these affordability exemptions, we're looking at year-end income. For the coverage gap exemption, we're looking at year-end income. And so even though he had periods of zero income during the year, it all sort of evens out because we're looking at year-end income. And so this is, you know, like I said, this is one of the points that we're trying to make to healthcare assisters, is that you can't save everything for the tax return. That some people, like Max here, would have been eligible for exemption early on in the process that he can't get now later on in the process because, you know, he's made enough income to, you know, to get himself, to make himself ineligible for certain exemptions.
And then one more really quick question and then we'll move on. If an employer offers multiple plans, which plan cost do you use to determine the affordability exemption?
So if there are multiple plans, you would use the lowest cost plan. The lowest cost plan that's available to each family member. So the lowest cost plan, you always start with the lowest cost plan that's available to the employee. Because remember our options on the market, on the affordability worksheet? The lowest cost plan available to the employee, and then you go to the lowest cost plan available to the employee's family. So if you're eligible for family coverage. So you're always looking at the lowest cost. If you have multiple options, you're looking at the lowest cost option that's available.
Yeah, hey, Tara, I would just add, because this question came in earlier, the Form 1095-C actually shows the lowest cost plan available to the employee on the form. So if you have a single taxpayer, you can actually use the figure right off the 1095-C if they have one. But
right.
For family plans, again, that information is not on the form, and they'd have to get it from the HR department.
Right.
We mentioned that if a baby is born during the year, they become a part of the household. It's not, you know, two people for the beginning and three people. It's just three people for the whole year. If a person as a family member dies during the year, is that person included in the household on the tax return?
So for the for ACA purposes, we are looking at the person who is in who is going to be on the tax return. So for a person who dies during the year, then those are, we'll separate this from the ACA rules, right? So those are, you're looking at your normal tax rules for who can be on your tax return, okay? So it has nothing to do with whether this is an ACA issue or not, okay? Bill, did you want to jump in?
No, I think as you said, the number of exemptions that are being claimed on the return should transfer over to the ACA worksheets automatically.
Yeah, so the question of whether you are claiming a person on the tax return, whether, you know, because of their death you can still claim them on the tax return, that's a general tax law question, and that's not sort of governed by the ACA.
And then this is going back to sort of exemptions, and again, we do have a webinar that's strictly on exemptions, so if you want to review all of the different exemptions and how all those work, that's a really great resource that I'll send around. But excuse me, for a state that at the beginning of the year had not expanded Medicaid, and then midway through the year they expanded Medicaid, would a person living in that state still qualify for that Code G coverage gap exemption?
Yes, and there were a few states like that that expanded coverage during 2015. And if you're in those states, yes, you can still qualify for the Code G exemption for 2015. But if your state expanded starting January 1st, 2015, then no, you can't qualify for the coverage exemption. So I think, unless I'm wrong, I think Pennsylvania expanded January 1st, 2015. Therefore, it's considered a coverage state all year, and you wouldn't be eligible for Code G. But there were some others that expanded, like maybe March 1st or something like that. And in those states, you can still claim the Code G exemption for this year. But then, obviously, next year you need to have coverage or a different exemption.
Yeah, and I would just add, if somebody lived in one of those states for 1 month and then moved to another, and they actually still qualify for the entire year if they met the eligibility criteria. So,
yeah.